My name's Ned Hook. I'm from the University of Alabama at Birmingham. I was the co-chair of the program committee, which was a great privilege. And I am so looking forward to this session. The three people to my left, your right on the stage, I think had one of the hardest jobs of this entire fabulous meeting, because it has been their job and their assignment to distill out the key messages, new information that have come forth in this meeting. As you all know from your attendance at the sessions, that's an enormous job because there's been so much said and so much done. As part of this session, and it's a little bit unusual, we will not be taking questions. We're going to go from one presenter to the other in the interest of time. So our first speaker is going to be Dr. Patricia Dittus. All of our rapporteurs are from the CDC. Her topic is an overview of presentations related to populations, special and general. Our second presentation is Dr. Thomas Gift, and Tom is going to talk and provide presentations related to interventions. And Kyle Bernstein will be the last speaker, and his topic is novel new methodologies and technology, but he has sort of summarized that by calling it potpourri. Either is probably an appropriate topic. I just want to warn each of our speakers that I am going to come up and stand next to them as they approach somewhere in the neighborhood of 18 to 19 minutes after their presentation. So I thank all of you for your attention, and I especially have to tell you, again, the job that these folks have done is enormous. So even before we start, let's give them a round of applause.
Thanks, Ned. Good morning, everyone, and thanks so much for coming. As Ned mentioned, I'm here to talk about populations today, which is a bit of a daunting task considering how many populations we work with in STD prevention. So this is a word cloud representation of the populations that were presented on at the last STD prevention conference. So as with any word cloud, the larger the word, the more representation or more sessions that focused on that population. We haven't done this for this conference yet, but perhaps we can persuade Alec Kakemo to get on that soon. So some of our target populations in STD prevention are well represented here. So young adults, providers, adolescents, women, and STD clinic patients are all well represented. However, some groups are less well represented, such as pregnant women and transgender people. So I'll be highlighting themes and providing a few examples for each of these populations: adolescents and young adults, men who have sex with men, pregnant women, and transgender individuals. And here's the point at which I can say there's just so much great work presented here this week. I couldn't possibly talk about all of it, so my apologies up front for having missed out on things that were quite important to many of you, I'm sure. There was just no way to avoid doing that. So a recurring theme throughout the remainder of my presentation is the conference theme of transcending barriers and creating opportunities. So identifying barriers and challenges, creating opportunities in different settings, and identifying missed opportunities for prevention. So first up, adolescents and young adults. For this group, the theme that jumped out at me was identifying and creating opportunities for prevention and care in both schools and in provider settings. So in terms of opportunities in high school, we heard about some successes, but there's also a lot of room for improvement. So for example, Nancy Brenner reported on DASH's School Health Policies and Practices Study, or SHIPS, which is a national survey that CDC conducts periodically to assess school health policies and practices. And SHIPS data can be used to look at trends over time. So here in this slide, we see a decrease in the percentage of schools that require instruction on HIV prevention, human sexuality, or STD prevention. Regarding the provision of health services, here we see the percentage of middle schools in blue and high schools in red that provided various services to students in 2014. So less than 1 in 5 high schools provide identification, treatment, or referral for STDs, Only about 7% provide condoms at school, and 11% other contraceptives. On the other hand, almost 35% provide services especially for GLB students. So this conference also offered some perspectives on the provision of sexual health services in college settings. Two presentations reported on a nationally representative survey on the provision of sexual health services at colleges and universities in the U.S. So the majority of schools had a health center, and of those, about 75% offered STD diagnosis and treatment. But only about a quarter offered express STD testing, and a third offered self-collected vaginal swabs. In the second presentation that reported on the availability of patient-delivered partner therapy found that only 38% had PDPT available. And not surprisingly, PDPT was associated with a variety of other services, such as diagnosis and treatment of STI, screening for STI, availability of LARC, and of emergency contraception. So overall, considering how many students they have the potential of reaching with sexual health education and services, high schools and colleges could be doing a better job. This week, we also have seen a resurgence of interest in school screening programs with varying results. First, the Washington, D.C. school screening program is in its sixth year in all public high schools. HIV screening of high-risk students began in the 2010-11 school year. However, as HIV testing was expanded, they ended up screening fewer students for STD and found overall fewer new infections. So adjustments have been made to that screening program in the 2015-16 school year, which incorporated risk self-assessments, and they discontinued the HIV testing on the STD screening day, which resulted in increased STD screening rates and at-risk students getting screened. Last, Detroit's school screening program is the first one to be associated with a sustained reduction in chlamydia across 5 years of the program. So here we see consistent declines in chlamydia positivity among female students from 16% in the 2010-11 school year to just under 10% in the 2014-15 school year. So what was different about Detroit? Well, one thing is that participation in the school screening program was consistently pretty high, around 79%. Also, the community services are pretty sparse in Detroit, so for many students, the school screening program may have in fact been their only consistent source of free STD testing. And then finally, anecdotal evidence is suggesting that the treatment rates are consistently very high in this program as well, well over 90%, which is ensuring that the majority of infections are cleared pretty quickly. Moving on briefly to some opportunities for adolescents in clinic settings, we have both some good news and bad news. So first, the bad. One study examined missed opportunities for HPV vaccine in clinic settings. So STD clinic patients who are at increased risk for HPV acquisition are under-vaccinated. So the question was, are these populations not accessing primary care, or are providers missing their opportunities to vaccinate? So here, missed opportunities were defined as occasions when patients received another vaccine in any healthcare setting and were eligible for but didn't receive HPV vaccine. So to find out, investigators used two data sources, New York City, STD Clinic Electronic Medical Records, and New York City Citywide Immunization Registry, and then they matched records between the two. So 57% of females and 49% of males had one or more missed opportunities for HPV vaccination. 40% of eligible immunization events resulted in a missed opportunity. So providers are missing opportunities to vaccinate a high-risk population with HPV vaccine. Then onto an impressive clinic example that used lean rapid QI to increase chlamydia screening rates in a large pediatric clinic. Chlamydia screening rates are low in primary care, especially among adolescents. Engaging primary care and public health QI priorities can be really challenging as they have a lot of other competing priorities. So this study evaluated a clinical and rapid QI training to improve chlamydia screening among well-visit patients aged 12 to 19. So the lean QI approach consisted of a 5-day on-site event, is a whole-team systems-based approach, provided no incentive funding to the clinic, but did provide a national QI expert facilitator and support team. And they found that annual chlamydia screening among sexually active patients increased from 28% to 57%. Same-day chlamydia screening increased from 16% to 43%. Both of these results represent a greater than 100% increase, and yet visit lengths remained stable. Moving on, next I identified three themes related to men who have sex with men, which could also be applied to transgender people, but I thought it was important to consider these groups separately, although there's certainly a lot of overlap in both the issues facing them and in the work that has been done, so you'll see a bit of that overlap reflected here as well. The themes are cultural competency and quality of care, impact of policy on healthcare receipt and health outcomes, and creating opportunities for prevention and care. So as an example of the first theme, Jose Bauermeister and colleagues used a secret shopper methodology to evaluate the LGBT friendliness of HIV STI testing sites in Southeast Michigan. So what you see listed here are optimal patient-provider exchanges, which include some basic things like respecting the patient and ensuring safety, privacy, and confidentiality. In the study, master's-level research assistants who were young, racially and ethnically diverse MSM underwent training and then were assigned for two people to visit each testing site at different times. Shoppers completed a quantitative checklist as well as an open-ended qualitative form right after each visit. They evaluated a large set of clinic characteristics, including the LGBT visibility in the clinic, so symbols, brochures, LGB and transgender inclusive language on medical forms, privacy and confidentiality, as well as aspects of the provider-patient exchange. So agencies were then provided with results of the secret shoppers' experiences to provide feedback on the ways that they could improve the quality of care that they provided to their LGBT patients. So the individual clinic score in green could be compared to the overall median and mean across all of the sites. And then they were offered technical assistance to the sites that were interested in receiving it. On to the second theme of examining the impact of policies for LGBT individuals. Say that twice. More and more work is being done on the impact of laws and policy on health. So I'm highlighting findings related to marriage. First, Licklider et al. Examined the impact of 2013 state-level policies focused on sexual orientation and found that STI testing decreased among gay and bisexual men as state-level same-sex relationship prohibitions increased, whereas there were no differences reported in STI testing among heterosexual men as a function of same-sex relationship prohibition. We also heard in Ellen Riegel's presentation about a variety of health outcomes that are impacted by policies, including state recognition of marriage. She reported on a number of studies that found that LGB people living in states with marriage bans reported more mood and psychiatric disorders, more alcohol use, more LGB identity concealment, vigilance, and isolation, whereas LGB people who were married reported lower levels of alcohol use, psychological distress, and depression. So finally, one example of creating opportunities for prevention and care for MSM. So Black and Latino young men who have sex with men and transgender women of color face structural barriers that contribute to HIV vulnerability and that impact medication adherence and retention and PrEP care. So an intervention focused on providing adherence support and retention to care was evaluated at Howard Brown Health in Chicago. So when comparing case management to no case management, they found higher retention rates for Black and Latino young men MSM and transgender women of color with case management than without. So 82% retention at the first follow-up and 47% at the second follow-up, as compared to just 36% and 26% without case management. The next population I'm highlighting today are pregnant women, and I've chosen to focus on congenital syphilis, provider adherence to testing recommendations, and missed opportunities for prevention. So one study examined provider adherence to syphilis testing recommendations for women with stillbirth. Patel and colleagues evaluated the proportion of women who had syphilis testing within 1 week before or after stillbirth, and the proportion of women who received prenatal syphilis testing. They also compared testing for women on Medicaid versus those who were commercially insured from MarketScan claims data. They found that prenatal syphilis testing was suboptimal, 65% for Medicaid and 70% for commercially insured women with stillbirth. Syphilis testing at delivery was very low, just 6% for Medicaid and 9% for commercially insured women. Women with prenatal syphilis testing were more likely to be tested for syphilis at delivery than those who were not tested, regardless of insurance. However, 34% of women on Medicaid and 29% of commercially insured women had neither a prenatal syphilis test nor a syphilis test at delivery. So guidelines are not being well implemented. In a related study in California, a case review was conducted to identify missed opportunities for prevention of congenital syphilis. They learned that most mothers who gave birth to infants with congenital syphilis had late syphilis and lacked timely prenatal care. Testing was frequently delayed or absent, treatment was frequently delayed or inadequate, and there were challenges in health department surveillance systems and follow-up. Recommendations were made for points of intervention to prevent congenital syphilis before pregnancy, during pregnancy, and at birth. Finally, I wanted to highlight two themes related to transgender individuals: best practices for care and stigma and discrimination. So one thing we learned about best practice for trans patients is the best way to determine transgender status, as not all self-identify as transgender. So the two-step method is recommended, in which a patient is first asked their current gender identity and second, what sex they were assigned at birth. As you can see here, it makes a big difference and captures nearly twice as many transgender people using that two-step method. Now, there was a ton of valuable information about health disparities and outcomes about transgender people, but I thought I would highlight just one thing here. New HIV-positive test results are highest in transgender people, particularly in trans women of color. We also learned this week that there are numerous barriers to healthcare for transgender and gender nonconforming people. So, for example, 35% of low-income or uninsured transgender or gender nonconforming individuals reported having been refused needed care in a healthcare setting. Additionally, most anticipate discrimination in healthcare, with 52% fearing that they would be refused care, 73% worrying that they'll be treated differently, and 89% feeling that too few healthcare professionals are adequately trained to provide appropriate care for them. A number of best practices for care were highlighted in Tonya Petit's mini plenary, as well as in Ace Eradics' symposium presentation, including the importance of gender-affirming clinical settings in which providers and staff use intake forms that are inclusive and respectful, ask patients what their preferred names and pronouns are, defer unnecessary questions and exams and build rapport before performing genital exams, and acknowledge barriers, including the stress of stigma and discrimination. Speaking of discrimination, one study examined correlates of STD among transgender populations. Lindley and colleagues conducted a secondary analysis of the American College Health Association's 2010 National College Health Assessment Survey data. Comparisons were made among 18 to 24 college students who identified as male, female, or transgender. They found that transgender college students had 5.6 times greater odds of an STD in the past year than cisgender students, and that students who experienced discrimination in the past year had 7.8 times greater odds of an STD than those who didn't experience discrimination. However, they also found that experienced discrimination fully accounted for elevated STD risk among transgender students. So rather than talking about gaps or what I didn't see at the conference, because I would surely make the mistake of missing some key work that had been presented, I think I'd rather mention briefly what I'd like to see more of at the next conference to address the varied needs and challenges of some of our key populations. So first, I think it'd be great to see more health communication efforts that create opportunities for prevention with adolescents, including LGBT adolescents, that make use of creative partnering, so for example, between public health and the entertainment industry, and the use of transmedia, that is immersive, interactive, and multi-platform storytelling. So in Wednesday's Adolescent Symposium, Kathy LeBax talked about the evaluation of East Los High, a TV series aimed at Latino youth that incorporates sexual health storylines into a very popular dramatic show. She talked about their partnerships, which includes Ford Foundation funding to support their research and evaluation work, but also how unusual it is for the entertainment industry to be partnered with public health in an in-depth way. This may be a promising direction to pursue. Another piece of what she described was the use of transmedia. So they might introduce a sexual health topic in an episode. So for example, one of the characters thinks that she might have gonorrhea. Then on the show's website, there is a resource page and further discussion of the topic by the show's characters, as well as opportunities to engage with the topic via Twitter or Facebook. Given what Rachel Kotcher told us about the characteristics of Generation Z, the group of young people born between the late 90s and mid-2000s, who are completely defined by technology and immersed in social media, if we want to reach this group of young people, this approach may be key. This slide just shows some of the Eastless High partners. Next, we now have a fair understanding of some of the factors contributing to congenital syphilis, inadequate prenatal care and testing guidelines not being well implemented, to name just two. Moving forward, I hope we could further our understanding of these factors and begin addressing gaps through an analysis of sexual and social networks among women and their male partners, including perhaps the overlap with drug networks. This could help prioritize interventions for women at high risk. Next, I'd like to see research efforts to identify the unique risk and protective factors for transgender people, including youth, as well as ways to identifying ways to reach this vulnerable group with effective health communication messages, prevention, and care, perhaps a longitudinal cohort study. Thanks to my many wonderful colleagues who helped me with this presentation and to the many presenters who so kindly responded to my request for their slides. I appreciate you all very much. Thank you.